Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Well, this is the last few days of our winter retreat time together. March the 28th today. And during these 3 months, there have been a lot of the daily readings of Lumpo Sumato's teachings have been a rich source of reflection and inspiration, I think, for myself and for many others. And I was listening to his teachings, reflecting on that, and reflecting on this place, Amaravati. Then what one of the things that arises is that sense of great gratitude that Lumpo Sumato put in the incredible amounts of effort and dedication, commitment over many, many years to bring this place into being, to inspire us to, many of us to go forth, to practice, and that and it's not an exaggeration to say that pretty much none of us would be here today if it wasn't for his influence in one way, shape, or form. So I feel a great deal of gratitude, a sense of great appreciation, and a sense of a real awe, wonderment at the greatness of his gift to all of us, the time and energy he spent, the incredible skill that he has had in explaining the Dhamma teachings. And similarly, Lumpo Cha, who was obviously the inspiring spirit for Lumpo Sumato in his early days of the practice, 10 years of training right at Lumpo Cha's side in Thailand, and then ever since then, very much the guiding spirit of this community, this whole family of communities around the world. I mean, in our practice, we put a lot of emphasis on individual effort and commitment, and we get very involved with our own mind. Certainly a retreat time where we have a lot of formal practice, also a lot of time for individual practice, we can really get, narrowed down our attention, focused very directly on our own mind, our own life, our own struggles, the things that we are trying to develop, the things that we're trying to let go of, our body, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our story, the people that we live with, our dwelling place, our routine. And so the attention can get very, very narrowed, focused on our own life, our own mind, our own body. And I think also the influence of Western culture, you know, the cult of the individual, and how it can be unconsciously influencing the emphasis on me and my life, my mind, my potential, my problems, and that style of thinking, that kind of attitude, has its effect. We sometimes forget where we came from. We forget our parents or our teachers. We forget the origins of our not just our body, but our way of life. As monastics, we are wearing the robes that the Buddha and the earliest disciples wore. You know, these were designed by Venerable Ananda, you know, 2,500 years ago. You know, we are the inheritors of a great ancestry, a long lineage of influence, And the emphasis on our own lives, or our own mind, our own bodies, our own feelings, and can say unconsciously ignore that or write that out of the picture. And that I feel that one of the great strengths of Dhamma practice and the reflections that we have on sharing blessings is, you know, right at the beginning of the sharing of blessings, the verses of sharing and aspiration, we have our preceptors, our teachers, our parents, that right at the very top of the list of those that we share the goodness of our lives with are those who are the source of our life, our biological source, our parents, but our spiritual source, our teachers, our preceptor, you know, the person who, I say, helped us to come into this way of training, the person who was helping to, support and be a catalyst for our commitment to the precepts and the training. So that sense of honoring our origins and respecting our origins and really appreciating that, I feel is, particularly for Westerners, obviously there's many people from Asia here as well, but most of us have lived in a heavily Asian, heavily Western-influenced environment, even if you were growing up or living and working in Asia. That's a powerful influence on our minds, the current of self-obsession, the cult of the individual, as they call it. So that the effort to step outside of that, to look outside of that self-centered focus, and to appreciate where we came from, the importance of our parents, our family, the importance of our teachers, the importance of our origins. This is not to be disregarded. So yeah, I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on people, but it's interesting how we can be living here at Amravati, kind of our mind filled with the routine that we're keeping, or the training that we're following, the robes that we're wearing, the people that we live with. And we can forget that the whole place only exists because Lumpo Sumedho had the idea, we need to have a big place. We need to have a big place where there can be space for the nuns to community to grow, where we can have a retreat center, where we can have a Dhamma teaching center that's really welcoming for everybody. We need that. And I think Amaravati is a good name for it. So because Lumpo Sumedho had that idea back in the early 80s, and here we are, that this place only exists because of him having that initiative and then stepping up to meet that, being ready to engage with the world and to look for a place, find a place, and to inspire people to come here and to help this this place to be developed. This temple is here. We are sitting literally, physically in this spot because Lumpo Sumedho said we need an inspiring building. We need a place to be the real heart of the community here. This is we need something that is an uplifting space. And so getting together with Tom Hancock, the architect, and looking through many, many ideas and through many, many meetings and discussions, and here we are. We now are gathering daily in this space. So how many of us sort of come along, sit down, put our bodies down on the mat, and then engage in meditation, and yet forget, oh, the only reason I'm sitting in this spot is because Lumpo Sumedho had the idea. Let's do this. Let's have a place. Let's make this. And again, I'm not trying to make people feel guilty or sort of make you feel bad. Or, oh my goodness, I never thought about that once. Yeah, but rather just to notice if that has been the case, to say, oh, look at that, how interesting it is. How narrow the focus can become, how obsessed the attention can be on my stuff, my thoughts, my feelings, my practice, yeah, how I'm doing, my success, my failure, my program, my feelings, and not look beyond that. So I feel particularly at this the end of the retreat time and having the very, active presence of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, so having these daily readings and then the themes for reflection that that he comes up with as a guiding spirit for this retreat time, a sense of enormous gratitude, appreciation for his gift to us, and that the fact that he's at the age of 84, he's still keen to be traveling and teaching, and has offered to come and spend a month in England next year, lead another open retreat for another 400 people or so. So if he's still breathing and if the place is still standing, then hopefully that will come together. And cultivating gratitude, appreciation, this quality of katanyu, katanita, gratitude, and katavedi, which is the response in terms of our action and speech based upon the feelings of gratitude and appreciation. So often that those two are, represented together. So katanyuta, gratitude, gratefulness, is the quality of the heart, and then katavedi is how one acts upon that. To reflect upon that and to cultivate that quality of appreciation for Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, and the incredible blessings that have come down to us from their diligence, their commitment, their wisdom, the strength of their practice, then it's also important to be actually carrying out the teachings that they're encouraging. Just earlier today, I was talking with some of the other Ajahns, and we're considering how it's kind of interesting how some of the people who've been most ardently devoted to Lumpur Sumedho over the years seem to completely miss the point of his teaching. Obviously, that's a subjective impression, but the people who are like incredibly dedicated to Lumpur and absolutely committed to his teaching, but amazingly insensitive to all the people around them, and seemingly devoted to the person and the idea of the teachings, but somehow also missing the point. And I acknowledge that that's a subjective impression, but that impression has struck me a number of times. How, not just with respect to Lumpur Sumedho, also Lumpur Cha, obviously they're the teachers I've been closest to, how that sense of inspiration or dedication, it can be sincere, it can be genuine, but it can also be a bit over-focused on the person, that the mind becomes attached to the person of the teacher, or the idea of the teacher, and it becomes an object of reverence, an object of devotion in itself, just like a Buddha Rupa. It can become an object of devotion as a kind of an idol, really, the best English word for it, to say that this is, you're literally idolizing that person, you're making that person into an idol. But if we listen to what Lumpur Sumedho is saying, or Lumpur Cha's teaching, what they're saying is, don't look at me, look at yourself. Also, it's in many of these teachings, these daily readings we've been having, Lumpur Sumedho would point out, that there isn't really an Ajahn Sumedho. If I don't create him, he doesn't exist. We come together and I'm giving a Dhamma talk, and you think, oh, Ajahn Sumedho is giving me a Dhamma talk, but there isn't really an Ajahn Sumedho. I have to make him. I have to create him. And if I don't create an Ajahn Sumedho, there isn't one. And you could almost kind of feel the atmosphere in the room. Some people will be understanding exactly what he's saying, and other people, what did he say? What's he talking about? He's right there. I can see him. But that, I feel, is one of the most powerful aspects of the wisdom teachings, both imparted by Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, and one of the reasons why their teaching is so liberating is that they could be very much a personality. They could engage with in a very heartful, attentive, mindful way with people very sincerely, but they were not invested in their own personality. And again, many of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, reading out to reflect on during these daily readings in this retreat time. He's talking about how if he attaches to his personality, it's instantly depressing. Or he said, my personality can never be liberated. That my personality is really, imperfect and problematic. And so that the quality of devotion, I would say, that sense of appreciation, gratitude, devotion that we have for a teacher, it's important to not idolize, to not just sort of be fixated on the person of the teacher or to be attached to those personal characteristics, but in a way to be really listening to what the teacher is saying and to be carrying out, to be acting on the teaching that they're describing, to be embodying that very teaching. So when Lumpur Cha would say, there is no Ajahn Chah, or Lumpur Sumedho, the same thing, that there isn't a Lumpur Sumedho, if I don't create him, he doesn't exist. Then they're not speaking idly. It's not just a figure of speech, but they're speaking about their own subjective experience, that the persona, the self image, is something that's recognized as being put together. It's dependent. It's conditioned. It's empty of substance, and that if it's not put together, it doesn't really exist. I remember one time before this temple was built, when we used to use the sala for our Dhamma gatherings and observance days. One time, Lumpur Sumedho was up on the Dhamma seat, and he was reflecting on this kind of theme, and he said to make this point, he said, "Okay, I'm going to stop existing. Watch carefully. I'm going to stop existing." Then he just sat there. It was quiet for a few moments. "Did you see it?" So I don't know whether some people actually thought he was going to evaporate, become transparent or invisible, but the internal change was that at that moment he was letting go of Ajahn Sumedho, letting go of the person, and letting the mind just know the present reality with no forming of a person, no kind of concretizing, no solidifying of I or me or mine. So from the outside, he didn't disappear. Body didn't kind of dissolve into a rainbow or become invisible. The body was still apparent, but the subjective experience of sumedhoing stopped at that time, as he was describing it. And so that, or like with Lumpur Cha, there's a little booklet of his teachings called No Ajahn Chah. And the title comes from an exchange that he had when somebody came to see him and asked him the question, "Who is Ajahn Chah?" Yeah, and he said, "There isn't one. There is no Ajahn Chah." So if you're looking for that, you won't find it. And again, this is not just a figure of speech or being clever, but pointing out that the persona, the feelings of I and me and mine, they are empty. They are constructed. They're dependent. They are conditioned formations that arise and pass away. And like every other aspect of the five khandhas, then they have a shape, but no substance. There's a form, but there's no real essence there. Like a word has a sound. And it carries meaning, but so there's a form, there's a shape, but there's no absolute substance there. There's no thing, no permanent, separate, individual thing that's really there. So when we are cultivating that respect for the teacher, or gratitude for the teachers, our preceptors, our teachers, and so forth, then part of that is to not be personalizing them, not to be letting that sense of sincerity turn into an attachment. Because if that turns into something that is, so I am your student, you are my teacher, I am grateful to you, I belong to you, you belong to me, you're my teacher, then there's a lot of grasping there, isn't there? There's a lot of me and you, and a lot of selfing. And so that a skillful teacher, somewhere, and that was something that was very, very visible over the years with both with Lumpur Cha and Lumpur Sumato, is that when people do try to attach to them or to try to sort of idolize them, they'll find ways to kind of burst the bubble, to not feed that, to not to encourage people to hang on to them or I say cling to them as a person in that way, but rather to look at that feeling of attachment, that look at that feeling of personalizing, idolizing, and to help them to see what they're doing with that. I've often mentioned how one of the most sort of striking moments for me in my early monastic life was when I was living in Thailand, and I was a very newly ordained monk living at Wat Bapong, and I didn't spend a lot of time with Ajahn Chah over the years, very little really, about 3 weeks altogether. But during this time, I was living at Wat Bapong, and he was there. And on this particular occasion, I was in the sala out at the front of the monastery, and a group of lay people came, so a busload of visitors arrived, and the group of people came into the sala, and one of the other senior monks, Ajahn Chu, was there, and so he just said to me, "Oh, can you go and tell Lumpur that some lay people have arrived and they'd like to pay respects to him?" And so I went over to Lumpur Cha's kuti, and to my surprise, he was sitting under his kuti, and there was no one else around. He was just sitting on this wicker bench underneath his kuti, where he would often receive people. And there was no one else around, no other monks, no lay people. He was just sitting there with his eyes closed, meditating. So I thought, and being a kind of anxious, nervous type of, oh dear, I can't disturb Lumpur, you know, what am I going to do? I can't. And my Thai was extremely basic at that point as well. I'd hoped there'd be another monk or his attendant around, but there wasn't. And so I sort of went up close, and then he didn't move, didn't make any kind of gesture of knowing there was anyone nearby. And so it scooted off, and I can't tell Ajahn Chu that, I couldn't find him, so I better try again. So I kind of went up close, and I was sort of wondering how to sort of make contact with him, who's sitting there completely still and with his eyes closed. And I said, Lumpur. And then he opened his eyes, and so we made eye contact, but there was absolutely nobody there. Like, it was a very powerful experience, because there was his eyes opened, and I was looking at him, he was looking at me, but there was absolutely nobody there. And then out of that nobody there-ness, suddenly Lumpur Cha appeared. Just like, he kind of put on the persona and said, "Arai," or "Het Nyang," "So what's up?" So I, it was an extraordinary, in a way, a visible expression of that coming into being, that in his own inner world, he was not having to be Ajahn Chah or anything. And then engaging with the rest of the human world, then like putting on a mask, putting on a costume, putting on the role of being the teacher, and just it was a very powerful experience of literally seeing a being arising, like a being being born, coming into existence, sort of right in front of your eyes, and so that. That was in a sense, a very clear insight or a helpful way of seeing that, this is what it means about anatta and atta, that that which is so familiar to us, me being a person, my name, my body, my story, my nationality, my age, my my feelings, my memories, my ideas, seeing how right in front of my eyes that there was a perfect object lesson of all of that is acquired, it's put on, it's not really who and what we are. And so when we are revering the teacher or paying respects to the teacher, then in a way that the best way of doing that is both to recollect the gratitude you have for that individual's efforts and their teaching and what we've received, but also not in the same breath to not create them, to not create a Lumpur Sumato or a Lumpur Cha, not to be creating an idea of them that you're carrying around. And that and that's, I would say, is the most perfect way of expressing your devotion, is to not attach to them, to not create them, to not be making a person that is then hung onto and carried around. Now, this is not easy to do, but I feel that that's one of the best form of expressing gratitude, is to say, carry out the teacher's instructions. And that when we do this, then it's not a matter of disrespecting or say, you know, it's not like going up to Lumpur Sumato and saying, you don't really exist, so why should I bother bowing to you, you know? Which is stupidity, foolishness. But in a sense, maintaining those two dimensions of reality, like having a left eye and a right eye, then we can see in three dimensions. So recognizing, oh, yes, there is the person and there is the personal qualities, and no, there's nobody. And that those two, dimensions of reality both being respected, then there can be that sincere and genuine qualities of gratitude and appreciation and affiliation, connection, but also a non-attachment. There's not a grasping. You're not having to carry the teacher around or defend the teacher. If someone insults Lumpur Cha or Lumpur Sumato, you don't get kind of angry and upset, like, how dare you? Who do you think you are? And then your love and devotion becoming a source of anger and aggression, violence, yeah, which can happen, you know, if you and that when that quality of devotion or appreciation is misguided. One of Lumpur Sumato's Dhamma talks, yeah, I think it's in the book Chitta Viveka, is called Attachment to Teachers, and he's talking exactly about this kind of area. Of how, say, when he was a young monk and he was very inspired and devoted to Ajahn Chah, but then he realized that when somebody made some kind of critical comment or made some disparaging remark about Ajahn Chah, I said, well, actually, you know, everyone knows that Ajahn Mahabur is much wiser and more spiritually accomplished. You know, he gets this, how dare you? You know, this kind of rage would rise up. And he thought, oh, that's a hot one. And so, you know, he was very observant, and he realized, oh, I'm really attached. You know, someone makes a comment that's rude or not appreciative or doesn't respect Lumpur Cha, and there's this anger, this kind of fierce rage that comes up. So what's that saying? What's that indicating? There's a lovely story in the Buddhist tradition that reflects this same kind of area from the time of the Buddha. It's in the a collection of the teachings called the Divi Avadana, stories from the Buddha and the great disciples. And it's a story of when Venerable Ananda was wandering through the countryside. And he stopped in this village to get some water. He was thirsty, and he went to the village well. And at the well, there was a girl hauling water, and she was from the very low caste. She was a chandala. She was from like one of the very low caste members of the village. And so Venerable Ananda, and she saw, you know, she had pulled some water out of the well, and Venerable Ananda said, may I ask you for some water? And she was like shocked. She, I guess from his, the way he spoke or his demeanor, she could tell that he was a person from a high caste background. Ananda was a warrior noble by birth. And so she was shocked, and she said, I can't give you any water. You're nobly born. I'm just a chandala. I'm kind of really low caste. You know, that would, yeah. If you drank the water that I've hauled, you know, that would defile you. That'd be terrible. That'd be really bad karma for me, and be bad for you as well. And so she's quite afraid and sort of cautious and doesn't know what to do. And so then Venerable Ananda said, "I didn't ask you for your caste. I asked you for some water." And he's plainly giving her the message: don't worry about that. And that's of no concern. Those issues don't have to be anything that guides our actions. That I'm a monk, and whatever your caste might be is completely insignificant to me. And don't worry about any kind of wrongdoing. There's absolutely nothing wrong being done here. And anyway, so she gave him some water, and he drank it. And you know, she was just overwhelmed by his kindness and this kind of respect that he had shown her. That she, as someone from the bottom of society, had never experienced that before. She'd always been kind of an outcast and pushed away and looked down on. And in the India of that time, so as even today, you know, someone from the lowest caste couldn't even cross the shadow of a Brahmin or a warrior noble. That would be a kind of terrible karmic results would come from that, or punishment, physical punishment ensue from that. So she was really touched and to receive this kind of respect and kindness. And so then as Venerable Ananda with the other group of monks were traveling on, then she followed along behind, because she was just overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude and appreciation and love for Venerable Ananda. So she followed this group of monks all the way back to the Jetavana. And I forget how many days it was, but she kind of followed along behind. And then when they got back to the Jetavana, then she kind of settled there in the monastery and was plainly in this sort of state of adoration for Venerable Ananda. And so then the Buddha heard about this and saw that this girl, her name was Pakati, was... there in the monastery. She wanted to help out, but she was also deeply in love with Venerable Ananda, and just so entranced and devoted to him because of this act of kindness. So then the Buddha called her to come and see him, and then he said to her in a very so kind and respectful way. He said, "You think you're in love with Ananda, but in reality, what you love is his kindness. So, you know, your mind has latched onto him as a person. You know that he's handsome and he's friendly and kind, and so that the mind holds on to the personal qualities. But what you really love is his kindness, and so that's not something that is confined to him as an individual. But you should see that it's actually kindness that you love, and that." Through that exchange, then she was able to get a perspective on that kind of intoxication that she had. She was sort of entranced and besotted with Ananda, and she was able to say pull out of that kind of romantic attachment and to see things differently. To see that that what she really appreciated, what was so wonderful and gladding to her, was the quality of kindness itself. So that I feel is an important story, and a very good example for all of us, because oftentimes the people that we love, or the things that we admire, the things that we feel we depend on, we get attached to the individual qualities. So maybe not just with a spiritual teacher, but say a particular place or a particular kind of food or some particular music or particular activity, and we say, "Oh, I love that! I love that taste! I love that color! I love that! I love that place!" And just as Pakati felt that she was in love with Ananda, that Ananda was the source of happiness. What we can reflect is that, say, when you hear a piece of music and you love it, or you eat a particular kind of food or drink a particular kind of drink, and there's this feeling, "Oh, I love that." The mind latches on to the sound or the shape or the color or the form or the taste as being what you love. But I feel it's much more skillful. And all right, being around a teacher, being close to Lumpur Sumedho or Lumpur Char, or an inspiring teacher, that you think, "Oh, I love them. This is so good. It's so beautiful. I love that." But what I would suggest is that we don't actually love the person. We love what happens to us when we're near that person. Or we don't love that food. We love what happens to our mind when we taste that food. Or we don't love the music. We love we love the place the music takes us to. That's what we love. So the mind latches onto the sense object, but what is really the source of delight within that, it's the mind state that it gives rise to. And so that if we don't understand this, then we can, even if we're professional renunciates, we're in monastics or living in a monastery, we can still spend a lot of time trying to get the right sense objects so that we'll feel good. We have the right colors, the right tastes, the right flavors, the right sounds, the right people, so that I will feel good. And we make ourselves incredibly dependent on a particular set of forms. We have to have this sound, or this shape, or this flavor, this person, this physical setup, in order for me to be happy. So that we can unconsciously become incredibly dependent, or like we feel like I can only learn from Lumpur Sumedho, or I can only learn from this Ajahn or that Ajahn. That we make ourselves dependent on external objects, on sense objects, and so I feel that. If we take this consideration, this principle, that we don't love the music, we love the place the music takes us to. We don't love that food. We love the mind state that arises when we taste that. We don't love that person. We love what happens within us when we're around that person. And you're very welcome to disagree with this if you like. Because it might sound as though it's being very kind of cold and clinical and encouraging us to be sort of hard-hearted towards each other, like a parent. You're saying to a parent that they don't love their child. They love what happens to them when they're around their child. Isn't love more than that? Well, I'm obviously you're quite at liberty to reflect and to explore this in your own way. But I feel as a basic principle, this is something that is, I found, extremely valuable to look at, to explore. And when you do, what you begin to find is that the more you realize it's the mind state that is the thing that is delightful, that is satisfying, that is, appealing, then you find that you don't need to have so much in the way of the sense objects. You're not so dependent on particular sense objects to find satisfaction. That quality of freedom, the quality of delight, the quality of real contentment, fullness of heart, becomes much more accessible. You're not always having to find a particular thing. You don't have to be kind of away from people to be happy, or you don't have to have this particular kind of weather or particular kind of thing that you're hearing or seeing or smelling or tasting or touching. There's an independence that of the heart. It's a freedom of the heart, because you find that it's in the attitude of mind that real satisfaction is found. It's not in the sense objects. So the sense objects can trigger particular attitudes, you know, to be inspiring or to be, you know, joyful or whatever. But if we don't understand this dynamic, then we make ourselves dependent all the time. We've got to have things a particular way in order to feel good, to feel content, to feel value, to feel value and worth in our life. And the more that we recognize that it's a quality of attitude where real satisfaction, real fullness of heart, real contentment lies, then we find ourselves to be much more adaptable. That, yeah, certainly, you know, there's delicious tastes and pleasant people and delighting in solitude, you know. But the mind is not dependent on that. It's not looking to that particular experience, that particular sense object, as being the source of happiness or the source of goodness. Rather, it's recognized that the heart itself is that source of happiness, the source of goodness, the source of peace and ease within us. So I encourage this in terms of a way also of reflecting on gratitude to our teachers, Lumpur Sumedho, Lumpur Cha, that in a way you might think, well, I love Lumpur Sumedho, I love Lumpur Cha's teachings. I so appreciate that. I'm not encouraging an ingratitude or a lack of sincerity, but to in a way to recognize that what we really love about Lumpur Sumedho is what happens in our heart when we hear his teachings. Or what happens within us when we're around a great being like that. What we love is what happens to our own heart when it's catalyzed by the presence of that great being. So it's an important area to explore and to investigate, to see how that works for ourselves. Because if our happiness is dependent on particular conditions, being around a certain teacher or having a certain physical sensations, being free of pain or not having to deal with particular sensations of heat or cold or being with people or being alone, then our happiness is extremely fragile. It's dependent. It can be disturbed and upset very, very easily. But the more that there's a recognition that the source of happiness is your own heart, and it always has been, and I would say always will be, then there's an independence, there's a freedom that whether the weather is cold or bright, whether it's whether the body is free of pain or not, whether there's sickness or health, whether you are praised or criticized, whether things are working easily or with difficulty, you're fine. You know, the happiness and the sense of contentment and fulfillment is independent of circumstances. There's a greater, flexibility, adaptability. Each one of us has our own particular preferences, our own particular areas of interest and activity, that our own personalities, our individual stories, backgrounds. It's going to vary from one person to another. But I would suggest that it's extremely helpful for us to look and to explore what are the things that I feel I've got to have in order to be happy. What are the things that, if it's like this, I can't be happy? Where the mind says, that's unbearable, or I can't stand that, or that's intolerable, or, you know, I've got to get away from this. I've got to get a hold of that. For each one of us to look, whether we're a layperson or a monastic, whether a woman, we're a man, older, younger, each one of us to look and see what in our lives falls into those categories. I can't stand. I've got to have. To look at that and say, and to use these reflections to consider, well, is that so? Why is the quality of happiness dependent on getting away from that? If I've got to be around people, why is that an intrusion on peace? If I've got to be alone in order to be happy, where's that coming from? Is that true? Is that so? Is that the whole story? If I'm criticized, or if I'm unloved, if someone is blaming me for something, is that unbearable? Is that something that I can't be at peace with? I've got to get away from. How is that? Where's that coming from? Got to have a particular living space, or got to have a particular supply of food. Got to have things in a certain way. To explore that, to look at those dependencies. To challenge them, to use this reflection on anicca, uncertainty. You know, is that so? I can't stand this. That's unbearable. Is that so? I've got to have this or that. Is that so? One of the reasons why we have the reflection on the four requisites, just to consider, robes to cover the body, alms food for the stomach, shelter to ward off heat and cold, medicines for illness are the most basic kinds. So those reflections on the four requisites, whether you're a monastic or a layperson, it's again holding up a mirror to that. What do you really need? What do I really need? What do I feel I've got to have in order to be happy? What I require as a person. What is that? Where does that come from? Is that so? And through that exploration, to challenge those dependencies, to look at them, to explore them, and then out of that challenge to discover an adaptability, a kind of robust quality of the heart that you find you can deal with more difficulty or hardship. You can deal with a bigger variety of situations, and then you feel that you can cope with, that you've been able to deal with in the past. You find you have strengths. You have a quality of resilience that you didn't realize you had. Just as Lumpur Sumedho would often remark in his Dhamma talks, when he had a major insight in his early days at Wopapong, sitting there being hot and sweaty and uncomfortable and eaten by mosquitoes, and his mind is saying, I can't bear it, I can't bear it, I can't bear it. And then having the profound insight, even as I'm saying, I can't bear it, I'm actually bearing it. Look at that. So to listen to those voices in the mind that say, I can't stand this person, I've got to get away from this, or alone at last, this is great. Is that so? The mind that relishes getting what we want. Look at that. This is what I wanted. Yes. Look at that. Explore that. What makes that good? What is that feeling of investing in it? Great. This is exactly what I wanted. Fantastic. And then seeing what comes from that when that's challenged or taken away. Like, oh no. I was enjoying that. Like you get back to your room or your kuti and you close the door and you go, ah, alone at last, yes. And then, no, leave me alone. What is it that's investing in solitude? What is it that's averse to company? Or it can be, oh, alone again. And then, oh, someone's come to visit. So what does the mind do? What's the mind invested in? And to get to know your own character, to get to know the territory of your own personality, what it likes to invest in. And then by exploring that, challenging that, developing those kind of strengths to see that if what I'm saying has got any validity, any truth to it. Yeah. Is the source of happiness our own heart, or is it really getting that food that you like? Getting that color that you like, or the being with the people that you like? How is it? So to find out for ourselves. And then when you do discover a greater sense of adaptability and resilience, to notice how that is, in a sense, find the quality of joyfulness, that sense of fullness of heart. And sometimes people would say, when Lumpur Sumedho was coming to visit last December, it was very lovely to have him here and listen to his teachings and to be around. And someone said, yeah, do you miss Lumpur Sumedho when he's away? And I said, no. So you're not happy to have him here? I said, yeah, I'm delighted to have him here. But don't you miss him when he's not here? No. So to some people that sounds really disrespectful or rude or hard-hearted. But I feel quite glad. I feel quite pleased to have that feeling that and I think that Lumpur Sumedho would also be very glad not to be missed. I feel is a very helpful, skillful attitude to cultivate. So when we relate to our family, our parents, our siblings, our loved ones, we're glad to be around them, but if they're not there, nothing's missing. Our teachers, our friends, happy to be around them, glad to spend time together. If they're not there, nothing is missing. So this is what we mean by independence. So one of those characteristics of stream entry is independence of others in the Dhamma and discipline. So that quality of independence is pointing to our happiness, our sense of wholeness, completeness, freedom, not relying on any place, anything, any person, but is from the realization of Dhamma itself, the heart knowing its own nature as Dhamma. What could be missing? What could be lacking? What could be a burden? So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.